This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. A couple of weeks ago, we were at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. I was joined by Megan Mullally and Nick Offerman. Mullally is best known for her role as Karen Walker on Will and Grace. Offerman's big break was playing the role of Ron Swanson on Parks and Recreation. But they also have a life together off-screen. They have been married since 2003. And as Playboy magazine wrote a couple of years ago, their comic chemistry is akin to that of a hypersexualized Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. Thank you both for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Let me begin by asking that the two of you, also I'm going to start with Nick because we've got to go one at a time here. And that is that what was the comedy DNA in your family when you were growing up? Did you come from a family of like rip snorting comedy people?
I wouldn't say rip snorting, but there is a powerful sense of humor in my family.
There is.
They're hardworking and humble. They're farmers and school teachers and nurses and librarians. Sorry. And so there's a real, I think it's the farmer ethos where you have to work. You can't be too funny or too dramatic. You just keep working. But you know, all of your year's work might be wiped out by locusts or storms, so you have to have a dry sense of humor of like, well, I guess we're eating our shoes this year. And I picked up on that.
And were you the funny one in your family?
Well, that might be over-egging the pudding, but I was definitely the showman.
The performer.
Yeah,
you mentioned in an interview where you said like your hardworking, kind of tough, no nonsense family. They viewed you as like the wuss of the family because
yes,
you're in show business.
I'm the sissy of the family.
The sissy of the
family.
When
I walk in the door, it's as though I'm the Milo of my family, yeah. Perhaps.
And you, now you were born in L.A., mm-hmm. But you grew up in Oklahoma.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well,
My father was a contract player with Paramount in the 50s, and so they lived in Los Angeles for a long time, and I was born here, and then when they moved back to Oklahoma when I was six, and I had a little bag packed by the door that whole time I was in Oklahoma, just waiting to come back to Los Angeles, although I had a great upbringing, but I knew better.
Now, did he feel like he didn't want to raise his kids in L.A.? That's why you went back to Oklahoma to have a...
Yeah, his parents had lived in Newport Beach, and they both passed away in the same year, and he just didn't want to be here anymore, and he was very bitter about the entertainment industry.
Right.
And he had grown up in Oklahoma City, and my mom had grown up in Tulsa, so he just wanted to get back there.
But can you imagine that? Being bitter about the entertainment industry. I wouldn't know what that's like.
Yeah, I think he wanted to be the big fish, you know, in a little
pond. Wanted to make it.
He really wanted to make it, but
he was
really busy drinking alcohol, so it cut into the acting time, yeah. He was very busy drinking alcohol and having sex with women who weren't my mother, so it really took a bite out of the...
Some people are able to juggle those pursuits.
Yeah, yeah. It's true.
But he was more of a specialist.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did he... Did he act in Oklahoma? Did he revive his career? Did he become like Tony Randall of Oklahoma, regaling people with his theatrical troupe?
My father he wore an ascot and at one point had in Oklahoma City in like this early 60s and had at one point bought a Rolls Royce Phantom III gray, you know, extravaganza. And he would drive that around town in an ascot. So the fact that he was not
Was he drunk on his way to bang a lot of women? What was that?
He just had a very... He was like a gay guy. You know, he just had like a very fantastical presentation.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. Yeah, my parents had a lot... I learned to sing because my parents had a lot of Barbra Streisand and Judy Garland records. And I was like, were my parents two gay men? What... happening.
Now, but did he perform? And like, I read that he performed in dinner theater there.
He was kind of the only person that I knew growing up who had this really, you know, kind of meta sense of humor. Right. And
he was funny.
He could crack my mom and I up for sure, but we were also scared of him.
Right.
So it was a good combo. Right.
Now, are your families, are your parents both alive at all or no?
My mom is alive. My mom's 95, yeah. She's still...
Where is she?
She's in Oklahoma City in the same house that I grew up in.
Did she get the roles?
No, that had to be sold, I think. But my dad never really had like a real job, but he had money from... The family had some oil money from way back when, so he kind of... drifted along on that, but the roles was temporary.
Was your dad around to meet him? Do they know each other?
No. Unfortunately, no. My dad passed away in 1992. But it's totally completely different as he and Nick are. I do think that there's some crossover because we're both gay. there's that. And then
wait, can they?
Yeah. Tonight's the night.
I don't know. It's coming out.
Can I mention what you said backstage? Backstage, Megan was staring at my balls when I was sitting down.
Yes.
Can you see the hole? Do you see the hole in my pants?
A hole in his pants.
I split my pants. Can you see it? Okay, I'm gonna put the paper here.
Alec Baldwin.
I'm going to put my notes here. I'll read
the
my notes.
The trouser hasn't been invented that will contain the testicles of Alec Baldwin.
They will not be reined in. They will not be reined in. Now, so there was no chance.
In, Nick has taken a rather festive handkerchief out of his pocket and wrapped around his neck in the form of an ascot. So
it's more of a cravat.
So the Offermans. Offermans and the Mullallys never met. I mean, where you got the two families got together.
Well,
I mean, that would have been an interesting thing.
Yeah, Megan's mom came to Manuka, and the families have visited each other, and Megan's mom had a wonderful gentleman companion, Mr. Nat Smith, and we traveled all over together with them, and so they came to our little town of Manuka for holiday dinners, and then we came to Oklahoma as well.
Now, Manuka?
Manuka.
Manuka, so I'm going to assume that Manuka... people even coming there from Oklahoma. I mean, Oklahoma City is Paris compared to Manuka, I'm assuming. And
they
so
they never even went. Chicago's less than an hour away, and they never even went. It was like going to Morocco or something.
Yeah. It felt like we were in Mayberry. When I finally got to Chicago, I felt like I had traveled from the 50s to present day.
You went to Champaign-Urbana?
I did.
Study what?
I'm a proud fighting Illini to study theater. Yeah, they have actually a quite reputable theater conservatory.
And that's what you wanted from when you were young? You knew you wanted to study acting?
I was really ignorant. I knew that I wanted to perform, and I only, as about a junior in high school, I found out that you could get paid to do plays in Chicago. Like, I had heard of Broadway, and I had heard of London, but I certainly didn't think I could get there from Manuka. I was ignorant. I didn't do the math that you watch. You know, my dad and I loved watching Jackie Gleason and John Wayne movies, and I never did the math of impersonating, like, oh, I can learn to talk like Reverend Jim Ignatowski on Taxi, and then somebody will give me instead, I just was like, hey, you guys.
I'm a wild and crazy guy.
He did have a breakdancing team with his cousin, Ryan.
Whatever it takes. They were TikTok
and flip-flop. Flip-flop was Ryan because he did the gymnastics, and the pop and locker here was TikTok.
That's right.
That's fucking crazy.
Guilty.
So you realize you wanted to...
We did plays at my high school. And
you just plays in high school?
Yeah, I did a couple...
How many people were in your high school? Like 11 people total? Or what,
no,
how did
there
that
were
go?
About 800.
Like you did Godot and 9 other people were in the audience?
That's
or what'd
right.
you do?
We did, you know, the crappy plays that high schools do. We also did musicals. And so it was a revelation to discover that you could perform theater professionally in as close as Chicago, and that these kids were studying to do this at the University of Illinois.
Right.
And I that was my first audition, and it was I didn't even know what a monologue was. Like, for one of my monologues, I performed a scene of dialogue.
You played both parts?
Yeah.
Listen here, Louis.
What?
Exactly.
You're like doing both parts.
I did.
What scene was that? What scene did you do both parts
it was,
from?
It was a scene from the play Steam Bath.
Ah.
So gay, once again. Scene from the play Glory Hole.
And the professors were
You could have done Boys in the Band and played all the parts from Boys in the Band.
Could have. But I honestly think they took 16 students a year in this conservatory, and I was very athletic, and I think that they do a lot of Shakespeare and big Chekhov plays, and so you need a couple guys to like carry the coffin or carry the samovar on stage.
He was an altar boy also.
I was.
What sport did you play?
It was Central Illinois, so basketball, baseball, and football. But football was my best sport.
Where'd you play? What position?
Defensive back, either cornerback or what they called monster back. I was good at tackling people.
Hurting people.
It was a little weird, but I had, I had the respect of the team, so they kind of thought I was fruity, but I think I was tough enough at sports that they were like, eh.
Yeah. You removed all doubt on Saturday afternoons.
Yeah. I was in the swing choir.
Yeah, you were gay until the kickoff. Were you a superstar athlete there in Oklahoma City?
Oh, no. I was in a ballet company, though.
Yeah,
I was a serious ballet dancer for many years, and I was in a company for 5 years and studied at New York City Ballet's School of American Ballet. I, on the other hand, basically came out of the womb in a top hat and tap shoes.
Yes.
I was developing my skills from birth. Yeah.
I had talent.
I was literally like in my room trying to perfect every possible performing skill imaginable from the age of four. I don't know why. I think it's weird that those kind of things happen. I think that when kids have a certain predilection for a career. I mean, I know so many people who had that.
Yeah, when I was a kid, we would always torment my mother because, like, when I was little, that programming on TV was like old Warner Brothers gangster films or like the Bowery Boys. I don't know if people here remember the Bowery Boys. Like, my whole childhood, we just like shoveled that on my mother all the time. She'd be like, "Are you boys going to finish those potatoes?" And we're like, "We're not going to eat the potatoes, see? Who's asking, see? We don't eat no damn potatoes. Get out of here, see?" And my mother would be like, "Oh, God, oh, God! What's happening?" What did you watch?
I liked the weird stuff, like Mary Hartman.
That's right, I watched that too.
Yeah, the fact that they even aired that in Oklahoma City kind of blows my mind when I think about it.
Did you smoke pot and watch Mary Hartman?
I was too young, but I had...
No, you weren't. Don't bullshit us.
Yeah, no, when it first started, I was. I didn't ever smoke pot till I was 17, I don't think.
I watched Mary Hartman. I used to blow a big fat one out the window before Mary Hartman was on. I love that show.
My mom used to watch it with me. She totally got it. My mom encouraged me in a lot of ways, and I knew every song on the radio and all that kind of stuff. And my mom always, she gave me ballet lessons and encouraged me to be creative.
Did you smoke a lot of weed there in Manuka?
No, in fact,
no.
It was very conservative, and the like the six known pot smokers were completely alienated. Like this was the '80s, and they announced their devotion to marijuana with long hair and like rat concert T-shirts. It wasn't even something you considered. Like there was such a taint on it. And then I got to theater school. And my best friend, Joe, it took him, at the time, there's a long side tangent. I was pretending to be a born-again Christian so that I could sleep with this particular young lady. And so I had to kind of work out of that to save face.
They were both born again, supposedly, and then he would like get her to like have sex with them, and then they would both cry and like get down on their knees and repent and ask for forgiveness, and then the same thing the next night, and just on and on every single night, every night. Born again.
She was born again and again and again.
Highly recommended.
And when did you decide you were going to go to become like a pro? You go to college, and what happened when you're done with college?
Well, there was a group of us, and I was really bad at acting. Like, I was so ignorant that I was trying way too hard, in a nutshell, was my problem. And so all through college, I wasn't really getting cast, but I endeared myself to this group of great artists because I could build scenery and I could choreograph sword fights. I became a big sword fighter, and so we formed a theater company called the Defiant Theater and moved en masse to Chicago. What's up? That was kind of the thing, was like, let's make a go of it in Chicago, which is probably the greatest theater city in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
For that reason, it's you can make a go of it with a storefront theater in a more affordable way, and your audience, there's no ulterior motive. There's no Broadway, there's no TV business. If you're doing Beckett in Chicago, it's because you really want to do theater.
Now, why do you think that is, to explain to people who don't know, and count me among them, why is Chicago such a fertile ground for theater?
I don't know. I think it's a combination of not being, New York and L.A., are places where if you have a scrap of
douchebags,
talent, yeah.
Is that what you want to say?
Yeah, they're full of douchebags. If you have just a spark of talent or cuteness in those cities, people are like, hey, we can make a lot of money with you quickly. In Chicago, you don't have that ulterior motive. Like, the top paid theater performers there are not doing that great. So it's
passion and love.
Yeah, you're not chasing fame and fortune, and you also just have that Midwestern work ethic. Chicago theater is a lot closer to farming than the coastal efforts.
I did a lot of theater in Chicago also, but before Nick, and because I'm older.
She went to Northwestern.
Yeah, I went to Northwestern. Is yeah. And then I did theater there for like 6 years, and that's where I learned everything, because I didn't study acting at Northwestern. So
what'd you study?
Mostly English and art history, but I did a lot of theater while I was in school. It was right when Steppenwolf was really hitting.
Sure.
I got cast in a professional show while I was still in school at Northwestern, and I was just starting my junior year, and I had gone back to school for 2 weeks, and I was doing 8 shows a week at I went in to talk to the dean, and I said, this is really hard, and she said, drop out. I said, yeah, all right, don't mind if I do. And so I did. And then I got some calls when I was doing Chicago theater. For some reason, I tested for the lead in Risky Business. Spoiler alert, I didn't get it. But I was flown out here for 2 weeks. It was a really big deal for me at the time. Then I had a lot of agents, like, you know, big agents, Hollywood agents, calling me in my little apartment in Chicago. And I was flown out for like 2 or 3 other movies, didn't get them. And then I moved out here finally in 1986. I don't know. And so I had an agent right away, so it made it easier. I always was able to support, I was very lucky, I was always able to support myself. I never had, a civvy job, which is kind of bad and kind of good.
What's the first thing you did that really clicked for you, where you really started to get you on that path where you you know you're going to work. I mean, I remember exactly. I did this movie called She's Having a Baby with Kevin Bacon years ago. No, no, please. But I just mentioned it because there were these two women who were the casting agents, and once I got cast in that movie and I was on their radar, everything changed after that. You know?
Well, I was lucky.
They were my benefactors.
I worked, you know, I was able to work here and there, and I got a pilot. Most pilot seasons I got a pilot, or I, you know, do episodic, but I never got any shows that really hit for more than 13 episodes. But then I got cast in a Broadway revival of Grease, and I was doing Grease, and somebody said, oh, they're going to do a revival of How to Succeed in Business yeah. Without Really Trying with Matthew Broderick, yeah. And you're perfect for the female lead. And I didn't know the show at all, and I rented the movie, and it took me like 3 days to watch it. I thought it was kind of boring. And anyway, I ended up auditioning for it, and I got it. And then we started, before we went to Broadway, we did it out here in La Jolla, and there was this guy who we still know who worked for the Hollywood Reporter at the time, and he wrote this review, and most of the review was about me, which was crazy.
Yeah.
And that really was the thing that kind of, that was my first really big break.
Yeah. And what about you? When you came out here when?
I did about 4 years in Chicago with my company, and things started to go well. I became better at acting, started getting, you know, good roles, and I had a year in 1996 where the whole year I had just the best possible shows. I felt like it was my dream year.
Right.
And I had a tooth, I had a hole in one of my molars that I could fit a peppercorn in, which was convenient on long hikes. But it dawned on me, I was 26. I was like, at some point I'm going to need to like see a dentist. And I've heard about the like SAG medical insurance and things like this. And so I had a couple little jobs out here that brought me out. It was very dubious. I mean, I was playing a bad guy in a weird cartoon thing on Nickelodeon. The producers were like, we can fly you out, but it's, you know, it's on Yugo Airlines, and it's a sub coach.
Yeah.
I landed at LAX, and I... coming from Chicago, just thought I would take the CTA to Hollywood, and I ended up finding a bus. I knew that Sunset turned into Cesar Chavez, so I took a bus to down to like right here, and then walked.
Oh yeah,
to
I know this deal
to Sunset Gower. I was like, man, I am.
Isn't it crazy the shit we did when we had no money? How we survived.
And you love it, and I loved it, and
I didn't
it
love
fantastic.
It at all. I couldn't wait to make money. And when did things change for you? And did you want them to? Because you sound like somebody who you weren't maybe quite sure that was the goal, was to make it, or was it?
Well, I wanted to, I always wanted to be, you know, to perform good writing. I mean, that's what kind of, like, I really thought I was going to be a theater guy, and I became one. But it there was something lacking. Like, all my friends in my theater company they sort of lost their fire, and they all dropped away and got jobs and had kids. And so I was trying to find my place, and I moved here, and I was kind of lost for a couple years, and I finally said, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I don't understand this business. I don't like it. I quit going to like commercial auditions and instead committed those hours to carpentry work. And finally I said, I just need to do a play. That's what I do. And I told everybody I knew, and some friends, again, casting directors, say are the reason we're all sitting here. I mean, these two great ladies that championed me said, hey, our friends are doing a play. And Megan was the lead in the play, and it saved my life. I mean, that's where you met? Yeah, that's where we met.
It was in 2000, and it was a theater company on the East Side, and he was sleeping on a couch in someone's basement. Quite a catch. I'd been looking for somebody just like him.
I had it all.
Get over here, you homeless hunk of man, you.
He had a pair of gold overalls that he wrote all of his notes on, like people's phone numbers and stuff, because apparently no paper. So it all worked out.
She said, come on over to my place and take a shower. You smell like you could use one.
He didn't have a bathroom,
no. He didn't have a bathroom.
But I
you guys met, what was the play you
had
did?
Had a pail.
Chuck Mee's The Berlin Circle.
What was it about? What did you play?
Megan played Pamela Harriman. It's sort of a comedy modernization of Caucasian Chalk Circle and...
It's like a deconstruction of Mother Courage, basically.
I played an East German soldier who did a lot of breakdancing. Mm-hmm. Named Werner Heine.
And he shaved his head for it, and he had a big mustache, shades of things to
come.
You
can imagine.
And he was about 40 pounds heavier,
right? I'm 37. So meeting Megan and miraculously having her accept me into her body was...
After a period of 4 months.
That's when...
4 months, though, that's extreme.
It was crazy. I had all kinds of... It really was very well orchestrated. At first... It wasn't even a possibility. We weren't going to date. Nothing was going to happen.
Eye contact then, took 3 weeks.
Yeah. Then we kissed. That was, he got in my car one night and I was like, get out. And then a couple weeks later, you know, there was a little making out. And then I wouldn't even let him come over to my house. Then finally he could come over to the house, but he couldn't come in. He could just drop me off or we could stand outside in the yard. But he couldn't come in. Then he could come in, but only the living room, and then he had to go. Then he could come in, and we would make out in the living
room. What are the Bronte sisters? What the hell is this? Jesus.
I don't know. Then he could sleep on the couch, but I would sleep in the bedroom. Then he could sleep in the bed, but we couldn't have sex. Then finally sex. I don't know why. I guess I'd just been burned so many times, I was going to be goddamned if it was going to happen again. I was just making really, really sure.
Wow. So then, how'd you feel about that, Nick? 4 months of what door I'm behind, or whatever she was playing there.
I would have, I would have done 4 years. Like I knew it was it, and so I was like, yeah, this couch is
really
comfy. Yeah,
he really had that confidence, and I think I was just so skeptical about everything, and I'd been heard, and I just didn't want to take any chances.
The 4 months paid off for Megan Mullally and Nick Offerman. They've been married since 2003. They describe themselves as simple, boring people and say one of the reasons they've lasted is that they like to go home and read books and do jigsaw puzzles and play cards to protect themselves from the craziness of the business. To hear from another family pair, take a listen to my conversation with writer Erica Zhang and her daughter, Molly Zhang Fast. What did you learn about marriage from your parents?
Mom, can I answer that question honestly?
Of course. No? Honesty is the only way.
Well, I would say, have you seen Kramer versus Kramer?
Mm-hmm.
That was my general impression of marriage from my upbringing. But, you know, my mom had some good, useful suggestions, but ultimately I sort of had to find my own way. Though she did eventually marry a really great guy, and they've been married for 21 years.
22.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My guests today are actors Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally. They joined me live on stage at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Megan Mullally had already done a couple of seasons of Will and Grace when she met Nick. Nick told me that as a cast spouse, he was what he calls the main mascot on the set of Will and Grace, and in that role, he learned a lot.
So it was the most incredible education and wonderland to be there and watch them make every episode of that show for the last 6 seasons. And I was just happy as a clam. And I also had my wood shop. Like, I was living the dream. And so when Parks and Rec came around, that was when... Thank you. That took it up an unexpected 17 notches where I was like, oh, shit.
It was so crazy. We have so many parallels because we both moved to Los Angeles. Well, we both had a Chicago theater period, and then we moved to Los Angeles when we were 26. And then we both got, I got cast in Will and Grace when I was 39, and you got Parks and Rec when you were 39, right?
Yeah.
So we have so many weird parallels. And he had watched me go through all of that, so he kind of knew what to expect.
Wow. You were able to kind of...
Yeah, it was kind of satisfying for me to see him like encounter some of the things that I had dealt with, because he thought that I was being whiny. He thought I was being a baby, and then he went through him and he was like, "I don't like it," and I was like, "See,
I don't like the color they painted my dressing room."
But for example, what? Like, what's something you were able to guide him about?
Well, the one that is so valuable to me, early on in our relationship, we were in New York, and Megan was going to do Letterman, and we were running 10 minutes late, you know, to get to Letterman, and I was sweating bullets, and I was new to the whole thing, and I was like, what the fuck is, what's going, how can we be late for Dave? What's the matter with you? And we get there, and there's some people outside that want Megan's autograph. And she stops to sign the autographs. And I'm
like, Jesus.
What are you doing? And we get inside, and I said, are you crazy? We're late to Letterman. And she said, if it wasn't for the people who want my autograph, I wouldn't be on Letterman. Oh, and I...
Aww. Now, when did you get the... I mean, I don't want to be campy about it, but when did you get the big phone call when you knew you were going to go do the big show?
Will and Grace,
but yeah, Will and Grace, what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Not How to Succeed. How did
Parks
that happen?
Parks and Rec got a lot more applause. I'm just saying. Whatever.
Stick
it's
around.
Right. I'm used to it.
I love, by the way, how he didn't mention Parks and Rec. He kind of laid back and was, then I got offered this thing called Parks and Rec.
Are you talking about the first time Will and Grace or this upcoming Will and Grace?
Well, Miss Fancy Pants, I was talking about the first round of Will and Grace.
Don't you guys want Alec to come on Will and Grace this time around?
One of the greatest lines I ever had. On Will and Grace, we did the live show, and I had ice cream in a bag. I was going to have ice cream with you, and you wouldn't let me into your apartment, hint, hint, made me wait 4 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I got the ice cream, and I'm standing there, and I say goodnight to you, and Eric McCormick says, your package is dripping. and I said, what can I say? I like her. That was like the most ridiculous line I've ever been asked to say on a television show in my entire life. But when you got the call, how did that happen? How did you get that job?
Well, Jim Burrows always called that lightning in a bottle. I had moved out there in 1985, and I had auditioned for shows every year, pilot season. And I usually booked a pilot. I was lucky. But then I kind of got burned out. And so around 1997, I was in the parking lot of a Bed Bath & Beyond, and I got on a payphone with my agent, and I said, Bob Gersh, I am not doing anymore. I'm not auditioning for any more sitcoms. It's not meant to be, obviously. And he said, yeah, okay, I think you are auditioning for sitcoms. And I said, well, I'm not. And then I had to pay my rent. So I was like, okay, I'm auditioning for sitcoms. So I auditioned for Will and Grace for the role of Grace. And they were like, no, thanks. And I went home. A couple of weeks later, I got this call. They want you to audition for Will and Grace. And I said, I already did, dumbass. And they said, no, for this other part. And I said, there's not another woman in it. And they were like, yeah, there is. And they sent me the script, and I read it. And I thought, oh, this is boring. Because it wasn't written the way that it ended up being. So I went in, and I auditioned, and then they wanted me to come to the network, and I was the only person, and this is so boring, sorry. And so
we are riveted. Go on.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that. I needed that little push. It was the day of the network, and I didn't know whether I was going to go or not, and I finally decided I would go, and I went, and I got the part, and then we went, and we had our first read-through informally before the big table read, and I was like, and then we had the big table read, and I was like, and then we shot the pilot And, well, before we shot the pilot, we were sitting there, and Don Olmeyer, who was a big friend of OJ's, A, B, network executive at NBC, came over to us, which is unheard of at that time for a network executive to come over to the horrible, shitty actors, you know? And this was when Deborah Messing used to smoke cigarettes, and she had a cigarette, and he said, do you need a light? And she said, yes, and he pulled out this gold Cartier lighter, this really glamorous lighter, and he gave it to her, and, she lit her cigarette and went to hand it back, and he said, keep it. And we were like, oh, we're getting picked up.
Ooh, baby.
I'm buying a Range Rover. So... So we did the pilot, and I don't even know why, but like it was mostly Sean Hayes. Like the audience just fucking flipped over him. And he had never, he was 27, he had never done anything, never been on a television show. And there was just an instant response. And then I thought, all right. And then about the 10th episode in, it started getting like really coming together. And I thought, oh, this could be really, really good.
Well, what's interesting, when I watched the show, when I came on the show, I decided to watch a whole kind of a bin of the shows. And your show, like when I did a sitcom, you really don't get it until a few episodes in. Like you're kind of your first season is nothing at all like your character in the third. So you're really nothing. Kind of taking more chances, taking more things on, you know, on yourself.
I didn't do that high voice at the beginning because I thought they would definitely fire
me. Fire you.
Yeah. And so it kind of like every episode it gets a little bit and a little bit, a little bit higher.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing, because you and I have such similarities, because I auditioned to play Kenneth on 30 Rock first. And I didn't get the part, and I went home.
Fools.
And then they wrote another part for me to play.
It all worked out.
Crazily, Jack McBrayer was almost Ron Swanson.
No!
Just kidding.
But he's not a hairy beast like you and me.
No, he's not.
You and I talked backstage about how we're men of a certain kind of a code, a certain kind of DNA. God bless you.
I'm
you and
hairy.
I.
Hard Take your shirts off, weather. You guys. Come on. Put your money where your mouth is.
They didn't pay enough per ticket for us to do that, I'm afraid. Now, how did the Parks and Rec thing happen for you?
Well,
who contacts you? How does that play out?
I auditioned a bunch for the show The Office, and I loved that show and the sense of humor, and I had known Rainn Wilson actually for a long time because we always auditioned against each other for like the weird guy in the basement. for real. And Rainn was scoring these victories. He had a great part on 6 Feet Under, and then he got The Office. And Megan and I loved watching The Office. And when Dwight would have a great episode, it would end, and I would say, you know, if I'm ever going to make it, it's going to be on a show like this with a part like Dwight Schrute. And so I had auditioned for them. Like there was a fondness, but I was never able to do anything on their show. A few years later, one of their main writers, Mike Schur, who also played Moe's Schrute. That's one of the best Easter eggs. He's so funny. So he and Greg Daniels created Parks and Rec, and Mike had remembered me. He had written my name on a Post-it and put it on his monitor. And years later, when they said, we're going to make Parks and Rec, he said, I want this guy on my Post-it on the program. They originally read me for a role that was a romantic interest for Rashida, and everyone, we were all getting along great. Everyone's like, yes, this is great. And they turned it into NBC, and they literally said, you said someone like Aaron Eckhart, and you fucking hand us Nick Offerman?
Wow.
No, thank you. So my part, Ron Swanson, was supposed to be an older guy, but they... bless them, obstinately said, all right, we want Nick on the show. We're going to make him Leslie's boss. And it took months. NBC was like, let's audition several hundred other people just to be sure.
Let's go on a world tour.
Yeah.
Every guy I've ever met read for Ron Swanson, except Jack McBrayer. And so finally, after 5 months, they had me in one last time, put me on tape, turned it in, and I got the job. And Mike Schur, my boss, called me. I had inured myself. You learn early. If you're lucky enough to test for shows, you learn quickly how painful it is, because when you test for the network, they have it figured out, so you have to negotiate beforehand so that you can't negotiate. Once they want you, you can't say, okay, I want extra money. So when you go into the audition, they put your contract in front of you, and it says this. It's like, all right, if you get this job, you will get $30,000 a week for many weeks. And, you know, you've taken the bus to get there, and you're just like, God, Jesus Christ, please.
You can cut that in half if you want.
Yeah.
You know, I'm cool.
And so then you're so crushed when you never get it, and so you learn to not get emotionally involved, and you're like, yeah, I know this doesn't mean anything. And I had done that for many years, so when I actually got the job, I just started sobbing, and I said, Mike, please keep talking to me, but I'm going to openly sob for about 15 minutes.
That was one of the greatest days of my life. I mean, it really was. It was such a
When he got the job on Parks and Rec?
I knew he was going to get it. It just took so damn long.
Now, we're going to be out of time, but I just want to ask you, like, what's entertainment in your life now? Like, do you go to the movies? Do you watch a lot of streaming TV? Because I read where you guys, an evening for you was what? A 25,000-piece puzzle and an audiobook?
We do.
On a table that you built?
We're missing The Bachelor to be here tonight. 3-hour episode. So I'm just saying, that's really big deal for us.
I'm sorry.
Big sacrifice.
That is our bag. Like, that's our ultimate escape, is doing puzzles while listening to audiobooks.
Oh, yeah. P.S. Anybody who doubts that we personally actually put every piece of that puzzle together, fuck you.
Someone doubted it?
That's right. Oh, yeah.
She's ready to play Karen again.
People want to see, like, a time-lapse video of us doing it because they don't believe that we do it.
Or they just want to jerk off to us doing a puzzle.
Very astute.
One of those.
So other than you streaming live for people to jerk off to your puzzle making, what is entertainment in your household? What do you like to do? Theater, film, music? What are you into?
Megan's the entertainment director. We watch.
Well played.
We watch a lot of...
No, that's my title.
No, she is.
Literally.
Yeah.
We both love reading, but we watch a great variety of independent films, foreign films, comedies.
And we watch a lot of, you know, cable and streaming shows, but we do watch the entire Bachelor franchise and Survivor. So yeah, I just need to throw that in.
We're deep into The Bachelor.
Are you into that, The Bachelor?
Oh, hell yeah.
You are?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
OMG.
Yeah.
Because I watched that show once. It was very degrading. They're like begging the guy to marry them.
Yeah, it's.
And I'm like, you know, the guy's a douche. What are you begging him to marry you for? Not all the time, but some of the time. Now, last question. Megan's mad that I cast aspersions on her favorite show.
Oh, I don't mind.
You don't care. What's for you? Is there a play in your future? You want to get back on stage anytime soon?
We both love working on stage. Last year I did Confederacy of Dunces in Boston. Wow. And it was a huge hit. It broke sales records for the theater. The New York community informed us we were not invited at the time.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. That's way above my pay grade. We were hoping to do it in New York and then maybe London. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, a couple plays just came my way that were long commitments, and I had to say no to them. And it was heartbreaking because they were super juicy.
Well, setting aside a new play, is there a classic revival role you're dying to play?
I love a lot of different genres, but I think you and I should do Ben Hecht's The Front Page at some point.
They just finished that in New York, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, we're a little late to that one, my friend.
Well, there's always Cleveland.
Yeah.
I love Martin McDonagh's plays. But I mean, I could go all night. I love. I was in Chicago when Tracy Letts started writing plays. In fact, his first play, Killer Joe, I was one of the scenic carpenters on. And so I really love his work, and I admire him a lot. But
when you do plays and you're a guy, like, you know, like I love Williams, and you track that as you get older, and you go, well, I'm Chance, and I'm Stanley, and I'm Val, and I'm Brick, and then there's a big leap to Shannon, and then your Big Daddy. Maybe the doctor in the end of Streetcar who carts Blanche off to the nut house.
Daddy is the leader.
But I'm not just saying this to be polite, because every actor of a certain age has their eye on Shannon and... in that play, you'd be great as Shannon. You'd
is that Night of the Iguana?
In Iguana. You should do Iguana.
I will reread it.
You would be fantastic as Shannon. Now you, what about you on stage?
Well,
reprising my famous TV role. Anytime in your schedule?
I've done three musicals on Broadway and one play on Broadway, and then we did something off-Broadway together. And then I got to do, in 2014, I got to do Guys and Dolls with Nathan Lane at Carnegie Hall. So that's doesn't get
style.
A lot better than that. And that role, you know, Adelaide, we're both like 25 years too old for it, but it doesn't matter because we're both the same. So I would like to do that on Broadway with Nathan. But I just did another play with him and Matthew Broderick called It's Only a Play. And then there's a new musical.
You just did the Only It's Only a Play not too long ago.
There are a couple of musicals, like maybe, you know, Gypsy or Sweeney Todd that I could do. But there's a new musical by the people who did Urinetown that I did a reading of in New York that I really want to do. It's really funny and wrong. But I mean, doing 8 shows a week on Broadway is kind of hard.
So it is tough. I remember I would do a Hector MacArthur. I did the 20th Century with Anne Heche. And when you do two on Wednesday, that's one thing. But when you get to Saturday, and let's say you have the flu, and you're doing two shows, and it's shows number 6 and 7. I remember we would do the matinee, and I would lay on my couch and on my bed in my dressing room, and I'd say, I hope that robbers come and rob the box office. And then come up to my room and shoot me on my bed and kill me. Because I can't go out and do this fucking play one more time. I'm so tired, and I'm in so much pain. And you know that when you're performing, you'll do anything to get the show must go on. So like, they come up to you and say, "We're going to shoot some gasoline in your ass to get you to go," and you're going to take the shot of gasoline in the ass to get out.
And
there
you
and do
always
the show.
Have to give it your all. Is the thing for people like us, you know, you can't. I've worked with people. I won't name any names, but I've worked with people who will sort of, you know, just phone it in.
I just
can't even.
God damn it.
Well, cat's out of the bag.
Well, let me just say that, and I'm not being hokey here, let me just say that whatever you do, everyone here will be watching, because the two of you are so loved and admired and respected by your audience, and deservedly so, because you're both so unique and so original, which is not easy to find in this business anymore. And as two of the great originals in show business, thank you so much for coming and being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alec. Thanks for having us. Thank you.
This week's show was recorded live at the Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Thanks to KPCC Southern California Public Radio, Alex Cohen, John Cohn, Tony Federico, and Melissa LaCase. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.